Welcome to the SEI Podcast Series, a production of the Carnegie Mellon University Software Engineering Institute. The SEI is a federally funded research and development center sponsored by the U.S. Department of Defense. A transcript of today's podcast is posted on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts.
So one of the most interesting recent applications comes from the Intelligence Advanced Research Project activities work on functional map of the world challenge. And you gentlemen were both part of that?
Mm-hmm. Yes, correct. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that, because that sounds like a neat project.
Sure.
I can get started.
Yeah.
So we refer
to it as IARPA. Yep. And if you are interested, then you can always check out a link in the transcript of the IARPA Functional Map of the World Challenge. What this was an image recognition challenge kind of on steroids. Hmm. So the problem was the United States has a lot of satellites that are fixed above the Earth and has an overwhelming amount of satellite imagery of portions of the Earth's surface. What they're interested in doing is finding out what's going on these plots of land. So there are various functions that can be ascribed to buildings or facilities on the surface of the Earth, like airport, amusement park, nuclear facility, hospital. And it's really important to be able to tell what's in this chunk of land for lots of intelligence-related reasons. So there were several sort of complications to the challenge that made it more interesting than just the standard, does this photo have a dog or a cat in it? Mm. But it was in spirit a very similar approach.
Yeah, I do want to add that the challenge had, so it's not just identifying the function of buildings, it's also identifying the function of a random piece of land. So is this a crop field, or is this a flooded road, mm-hmm. et cetera? And there's, again, a variety of applications for this. IARPA obviously would be intelligence-based, but there's also large amounts of humanitarian right. use cases for this stuff. Right. One distinct thing that I can imagine is a really heavy use case of satellite imagery was I forget which fort it was, but there was a city in Fort something in Canada which was ravaged by wildfires mm-hmm. a year or two ago. And one of the things that happened was when humanitarian workers went in to do rescue operations and to provide aid, they didn't know where structure stood anymore. Mm-hmm. So they had to use satellite imagery to identify what a certain, like this square on the map now was actually a hospital before, et cetera. So there's a lot of use cases for stuff like this.
And so that could help them better navigate hazards. It could help them understand, you know, where there might not be anything solid to stand on, even though it's not apparent here.
Exactly.
Or where there might be more people in need of rescue.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, yes.
Yeah, there's not a barn here anymore because it burned down, but there used to be one, and that's actually, we need to know that.
And we can tell you that because we know what the function of the land is. So therefore, the functional map of the world challenge, right?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So. Yeah. You guys, could you talk a little bit more about the collaboration you had on the Functional Map of the World project?
Sure. So I can start off on that. Our goal for entering the challenge was kind of twofold. One was to basically work on a fun little problem that had real use cases for the United States government. And the other was basically to try out very new methods ourselves and find limitations within our own infrastructure, mm-hmm. Within our own methodology, et cetera. So there was kind of a two-pronged way. It wasn't necessary to win the challenge. So what we did was basically, the task is you're given 62 different possible functions of the world, plus one false detection category. So that means that this was just bad label data. And the task was that you're given about 5 terabytes of data, of which about 65% is training data, mm. And training data does not contain false detections. So can you, using that data, in the best manner possible, identify the land use of the satellite imagery. So what we did was we tried a variety of methods to do that. A variety of existent methods, deep learning methods, using models such as dense nets, using models such as SE nets, that's squeeze excitation networks, etc.
So if I can interrupt for
sure.
a second. You can, a very high-level view of this is that this is just an image recognition challenge, which is what deep learning kind of came to fruition in proving to the world it was good at. Image recognition is, like, the slam dunk success of deep learning so far. And so we said, not only we, the people who instantiated the challenge said, here's a starter deep learning architecture. So we used a variety of different deep learning methods that have been used for image recognition in the past. Other such challenges were given all the set of, we're like labeling all of the images that made it onto Google Images. So the technology behind this is convolutional neural networks, which is a really good way to get into deep learning if you're interested in learning more.
Yeah, and so again, Carson mentioned that this is not, previously mentioned, this is not a standard image recognition task, not a standard image classification task. Mm-hmm. And that's because, you know, generally when we're talking about categories, like classification, like it's like dogs versus cats, or it might be something that's very close, like, oh, Porsche versus Lamborghini, or some like certain sports cars. This one is unique because you have satellite imagery, which for a large part of the Earth is very homogeneous, right? One patch of forest in the USA might look exactly like a patch of forest in the Amazon, right? Or a city from like a zoomed out view might look the same on the next city. So the idea is that like how can you take these very minute differences, not only in scale, but also in landscape, the buildings on there, etc., and identify different function like land functions. Mm-hmm. So this makes it very different from just a traditional image classification problem because you actually have to take in not only the object of interest, which is like let's say a building, but also its entire surroundings.
So for example, what a farm looks like in Kansas,
correct,
versus what a farm looks like in New Delhi.
Correct.
They're very different things. Yep. Not only are they growing different crops, but the size of the fields, the machines used, mm-hmm. the seasons that activity happens are very different. And so this challenge needs to be able to accommodate those kinds of sources of variation.
Yeah. Correct. Like crop fields in Kansas, like crop fields in Kansas have the irrigation circles, right? It's very modern technology to use irrigation circles. Crop fields in New Delhi don't have that. They're usually hand watered or they have the pipes running in the field. So from satellite imagery, those would look very different from each other. So identifying something like that is important, but you don't really get that in just general deep learning tasks.
And so the feature learning task is what addresses.
This is the most critical part of this challenge, yes.
If I can pull that back to our feature representation discussion from earlier, you know, unless you are like a world expert in what satellite imagery should look like, or you know a lot about maybe farming techniques or whatever, it could take you years to determine this is what a crop field in Kansas is going to look like, this is what one in New Delhi is going to look like. You have terabytes of data, you don't have enough time in order to make that happen. So that was the whole reason that we needed to use this deep learning strategy, is because we're not experts on what satellite images look like, but the computer can become one.
Yeah. And it's not to say that we're not like completely clueless about satellite images. We have some idea, which we try to incorporate in the models, but the idea is that it can take our cluelessness or some naive knowledge of it and build on top of it and become really good at identifying all these things.
It's the power of what the algorithms and the techniques are able to do beyond whatever the human brings to it that we're really trying to test with this challenge.
Correct. And I think one of the biggest things is not only what can it do beyond humans, but the computational power and an infrastructure that lies behind the deep learning, which really powers it. We are really good at doing all these really cool abstract tasks, like we being humans, like identifying what your grandmother looks like with one look at your grandmother, et cetera, or reasoning about complex things like, oh, that's a bookshelf, and looking at those books, we're probably in a software engineering institute, et cetera. What computers are really good at is doing one thing really well and really fast. Really fast, much faster than humans can. So how do we best leverage all that architecture, the infrastructure that's been built around or is already existent for various different tasks to work for deep learning? And a part of the challenge that we really focused on, actually, was how do we best create an infrastructure that facilitates this deep learning task? There are a lot of small research centers, there are a lot of big research centers which have a lot of heterogeneous hardware out there, and all of it may not be best suited for machine learning. And so one of the best things that we did focus on for this research was how do we best help people in those situations create deep learning stacks that would work really well and perform it and best facilitate the learning task at hand.
Okay. Yeah, I think this actually calls to mind a really interesting part of this project and something that it was a great idea that the ETC data science group and the CERT data science group were able to come together on this. So Ritwik faced this, we've got terabytes of data. It took a week to download. Wow. We've got, yeah, it's like you were running up just the bare metal, like the electrons were causing you problems sometimes. Yeah. And from my perspective as a mathematician and in the CERT data science group, we mostly have a statistics background actually. Mm. So I was, listen, I don't know how computers work at all, but I know like kind of a lot about how linear algebra works and how the theoretical gains that need to be addressed and made in order to do better on this project. So it was actually really awesome to be able to realize that we needed both of those perspectives on the project. And a group that is trying to do a project like this themselves needs to have people who've got both of those skills. Yeah. If your data's huge, you can't go without someone who knows about the electrons. Yeah. If your data is huge, you can't go without someone who knows about the math. You need both.
Yeah, you can see like big groups like Google, Microsoft, Apple, et cetera, do really well at this, right? They have people who are cloud engineers who are really good at the infrastructure, and you have people who are just deep learning scientists or machine learning scientists who are really good at the math. And they work together in one lab to make themselves the best AI labs in the world. Even if you're not at that skill, even if you're not a Google, even if let's say you're just a three-person team, it is essential to be able to identify your underlying infrastructure limitations and identify workarounds to those problems so that both tasks can be best facilitated. And there's trade-offs that come with both of those, both on the learning side and on the infrastructure side. You have to identify the best trade-off for your situation.
So there are features to be discovered in what infrastructure is needed.
Right. And so part of the research that we did focus on is what kind of trade-offs would you have to make to do this? Again, as a software engineering institute, we focus on the software engineering part of it. So what engineering challenges are there to architect a system that would work on, you know, this is a relatively small data set, small being 5 terabytes, right? Because their data sets are much bigger than that.
Yep.
But even 5 terabytes, how do you handle a data set of that size? We focused heavily on that research.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Thank you for joining us. Links to resources mentioned in this podcast are available in our transcript. This podcast is available on the SEI website at sei.cmu.edu/podcasts and on Carnegie Mellon University's iTunes U site and the SEI's YouTube channel. As always, if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to email us at info@sei.cmu.edu. Thank you.